Praise God. It's so good to see you all here. If you haven't been here in a while, welcome. If you're new, it's your first time here at Wasatch Hills, welcome. We're just so glad you're here. You know, when Greg was asking what October was all about, we were thinking pumpkins, harvest, you know, all kinds of things like that. You surprised us a bit today. Yeah, fall. You surprised us with pastor appreciation. I was sitting there here during the children's story, just adoring the kids of Wasatch Hills, and was just thinking to myself, there is no better church in the whole world than right here at Wasatch Hills. And so that's what was going on in my head, and to receive that love and appreciation from all of you just means so much to us. We just wanted to say thank you as we begin this message today. Title of the message, The Scarcity of Abundance. I mean, if that's not an oxymoron, I don't know what is. But the reality is that true abundance is scarce. It's rare. It's difficult to find. We were reminded of this scarcity mindset during the pandemic when some of us became hoarders of things.
Just certain.
Yeah, just certain things. All you have to do is tell somebody that they might not have enough toilet paper, and suddenly they're going to wish they had more toilet paper. And so what do? We zoom off to Costco, we buy the mega pack, right? I saw pickup loads of toilet paper out in front of Costco at times, during the beginning of the pandemic. And there's something that is vital that we explore today, and that is why. You know, why is it that some of us are inclined to just create this stash, to just get more than enough? And what drives that? And so that's kind of the thing that we want to explore today together.
And if one pack is good, then maybe we need 10 packs. And I think that's what we saw a lot of during that time.
Yeah, definitely. I think... And part of what I want to present to you today is I think it's been something that's been with humanity for a very long time. In fact, when Adam and Eve rebel against God, when they decide, hey, we want to live a different story than the God story, we want to live a different story than the Garden of Eden story, as soon as they make that decision, God describes what reality will be like for them. Oftentimes, we see this conversation in Genesis 3, and we think, oh, okay, these are curses. God's cursing them. I don't think it's so much that as it is God saying, okay, you want to live life outside of me and outside of my kingdom? Okay, but let me tell you what it's going to be like. And we see this very descriptively here as God speaks to Adam and Eve and says this. Becky, read this verse
for us. By the sweat of your face you shall eat bread till you return to the ground, for out of it you were taken, for you are dust, and to dust you shall return.
So God says, in the day that you eat of that tree, you will surely die. You're really going to die. And some people read that verse and they're like, yeah, but they didn't, right? They kept on living. But the Hebrew itself, embedded in that language, it's the language ought to be translated, in the day that you eat of it, dying, you will die. You will begin the dying process. And here God explains this to Adam, that he's going to have to toil to produce. There's going to be scarcity in his life, and ultimately, he's going to lose it all, and he's going to end up returning to the ground. He's dust, and he's going to return to dust. That's the last thing that God says to Adam. And then the narrator tells us this in Genesis.
The man called his wife's name Eve because she was the mother of all living things.
It's the first time in the book of Genesis that we know her name. Before that, it's man, Hebrew, Adam, and she's woman. It's kind of like man and woe man. That's her name. And it's not until now that he names her. And he names her Eve. And it's like the ultimate of denial, isn't it? To be told that you're dust, and to dust you're going to return. Death is your future. Death is what lies in front of you. And Adam says, I'll name her Living. And it's like, I'm going to deny reality. I'm going to deny what God is telling me, and I'm going to name her Living. And yet, the very next verse tells us that actually she is a source of life. She is the mother of all the living.
Now Adam knew Eve, his wife, and she conceived and bore Cain, saying, I have gotten a man with the help of the Lord. And again she bore his brother Abel.
You know, any of us that have ever taken biology class, we realize the miracle that happens when half of a human genome joins another half of a human genome, and these two gametes fuse, and a cell divides into two. And then a cell divides into four. And then four divides into 16. And exponentially, this one cell just continues to expand and grow and form organs and veins and spinal tissue and nerves. And everything just kind of, this miracle happens. This life begins. And the life begins inside of this mother who is this nurturing, perfect environment. And this child develops in that place, I remember the miracle, you know, when you became pregnant the very first time. I remember that miracle of knowing there's a human life that was being formed in there. It had everything that it needed. Every need was met inside of the mother. And one of the dilemmas that we face in our lives is that nurture that begins at conception and grows into that child, that nurture that a child receives has to continue after that child is born. It's vital for us to be nurtured and to be cared for, to be seen, to be looked at, to be adored. I think maybe that's why I found so much joy in watching the children's story this morning. Just adoring these kids is a gift that we can give to them that enhances their well-being and gives them not a scarcity mindset, but an abundance mindset.
Not every child has that nurturing, though, do they?
They don't all have it. And in fact, scientists believe that to the degree that we are nurtured, especially by our mothers, but by our parents as we grow up, to the degree that we are nurtured, we either have a scarcity or an abundance mindset. Check out this quote here.
Emotionally healthy young people who were both self-reliant and able to rely on others had a home in life in home lives in which both parents were loving and emotionally generous, and the mother had given them a feeling of complete security.
So one of the answers to the question, why do we hoard toilet paper, is because we experienced scarcity in our upbringing, right? And of course, this kind of leads to this whole psychological world that I, as a parent, don't feel very comfortable with, and that is if you have problems, blame your parents, right? That sounds great until you are one. Right?
And then it's not so great.
And then suddenly the blame comes to you. And I don't know what the grandparents get. I hope the grandparents just get all the glory. That's kind of what I'm rooting for here now. But that is part of the science that suggests that what makes me a hoarder might have to do with some of those kinds of things. What makes us have that mentality. But it's also trauma. It's also crisis. It's also believing the whole world's about to come to an end in a giant pandemic, and what if I don't have enough toilet paper? I mean, that is definitely what you're going to need the most of when it really all goes down.
Right. So children need nurtured and they need cared for, but they often, a lot of times, we don't really get exactly what we need.
Yeah.
From our
parents.
Something's
missing. Yeah.
Something, yes.
And there's a vital question that you can ask to kind of assess your condition. Is this me? You know, am I somebody who has a scarcity mindset, or am I somebody who has an abundance mindset? And this is a question that author John Eldridge in his book Resilient suggests is a question that you could ask.
Are my reactions to hardship as an adult proving that I received, beyond a shadow of a doubt, the assurance of abundance as a child?
How do you react to crisis? How do you react to trials and difficulties? Do you go, wah? You know, that might indicate that you kind of grew up with scarcity, that you don't have this sense that it's not a zero-sum game, that there is abundance out there, and that abundance can be experienced and found and realized in your life. Or do you have this sense that there's plenty out there, and that can be the case for you too? And this is the thing that I think is important for us to remember. As parents, as children of parents, it's important to remember that, guess what? None of us have perfect parents, right? You look at this question, and my reaction to hardship as an adult proves proving that I received beyond the shadow of a doubt the assurance of abundance as a child. Most of us would read that question and we would say, not so much.
Right.
Not so much. Why? Because even if you have the best parents, even if you have people that provided for your every need, they're still sinful, fallen human beings.
Right.
They're imperfect. They couldn't meet all of your needs completely. And so you still grew up feeling like some of your needs weren't being met. I was missing something in my life. Something wasn't there for me. I was missing something. And what do? When you feel that way, you hoard toilet paper. You become somebody who has a scarcity mindset, and you collect and collect.
So the real test is, how much toilet paper did you buy during COVID?
Yeah.
Is that what you're saying?
That's the real test. Yeah.
You know, we bought a really nice large case, and then he went to Costco and they had it there. Most of the time they didn't have it there, and he said, well, other people might need it, so I'm going to get more. And then maybe other people would need even more. And so we had, I think we just had to buy toilet paper for the first time since 2020.
We shared toilet paper with friends.
We did.
We did our best. I think Dave and I used toilet paper as a prop in one of our first videos that we did. We did the sermon with water bottles and toilet paper all stacked up around us for one of those first presentations. It was useful, and it was rare.
Very
like
rare.
Stained glass. Yeah. So I want to talk a little bit about my experience. You remember that in this sermon series, we've spent some time sharing about one of the big traumas in our lives. Those of you that are new to Becky and I may have noticed when we came up for the pastor appreciation, I helped her up the steps. I helped her back down the steps. Becky is an incomplete Brown's Accord person that you could call it, one layman's terms kind of way of referring to it, is incomplete quadriplegia. She is affected all four limbs from the neck down. She has lack of motor control on the left. She has lack of sensory, hot or cold, sharp or dull sensation on her right, even though her right hand is very, and leg are very mechanically functional. She has this condition because of a car accident where she broke her vertebrae at C4 and sustained a spinal cord injury. And we shared the story in our last sermon about the development of Becky's chronic pain and how she learned how to manage her pain and went through that crisis. But I haven't really told you my part of that story. We were pastoring in Great Falls, Montana when Becky's chronic pain really became serious. And she told you about that trip where we'd stop every few miles and she'd lay in the grass and cry. And it got to the point where when we finally got to Northern California, I actually found a flight for her and I flew her back home and I drove back home. I just didn't want to put her through that miserable experience again to get back home. But I've got to tell you guys, as a pastor especially, I think just as a follower of Christ, it would be the same. But as a pastor, when you have a crisis of faith and you're the pastor, that's really tough. And there is, in my experience, there is no greater crisis of faith than to see somebody that you are one with, somebody that is a treasure in your life, burning nerve pain from the neck down that is uncontrollable and she can't seem to get it managed at all. Medications don't work. Surgeries are impossible, can't be done, would cause further paralysis with the condition that she has. And you know, what do you do with your walk with God when you realize that God has the power with like the blink of his eye, he has the power to completely, fully restore her from her injury. Take away all that pain, take away all that paralysis. He could fix it. Doctors can't. Medications can't. Nobody can fix it, but God can. And you know that as a preacher. You've read those miracle stories in the Bible about the paralytic that is healed and fully restored, takes up his bed and walks. And what do you do with that? Well, I found myself in a really tough spot. I found myself with that question that many of you have probably asked too, and that is, what kind of a God would allow this to happen in the world? And I felt myself really struggling, really in pain, really suffering with it. To the extent that you may or may not know this, but by policy, Seventh-day Adventist pastors can take a 2-month sabbatical every 7 years. Well, I had been 7 years since my last sabbatical, and I realized I need to take some time. I have this time due, and I need to take some time to go out to a shack in the woods and fight it out with God. I'd read a book about that called The Shack or something. Yeah. And I thought, I'm going to go out and I'm going to fight it out with God a little bit. I'm not very happy with him right now. And I packed up all my stuff to go. There was a cabin that the Montana Conference owned that was out near where the Unabomber used to live. Remember the Unabomber, the guy with the sunglasses and everything, mailing packages to federal judges and hurting a lot of people? He lived in that basic area until he was apprehended by the FBI. And I thought, that's a good place. I'll really get away. I'll get off the grid and stay in this cabin. And I started to put all my gear, all of my stuff in my bags to go. And being a pastor, it's like, okay, I'm going to wrestle with God, so I need books. I need books. And so I looked through my library, and I grabbed a few books that I thought, this is the stuff I need to read to crunch through all of this. And I have a collection of books by Philip Yancey. I don't know if you know Philip Yancey. He was editor of Christianity Today. Some of you have studied his books in your Sabbath schools here at Wasatch Hills. And I saw this book on my library, and I saw the title of it. Can you read that? Some of you can. Disappointment with God. And I said, yep, that's me. And I pulled it off my bookshelf, slammed it in the box, hauled it off to the woods, and this ended up being the book that I read during my sabbatical in the woods. And I want to show you something. See that bookmark in it there? It's about two-thirds of the way into the book. I was reading through, I got all my highlighting, all my little notes, a few cynical comments, and different things in there. And then I get to this bookmark spot, and in my margins here I wrote, GC, 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 GC. That's about it, okay? That does not stand for General Conference. Okay, just so you all know. Okay? Not General Conference, it's Great Controversy. I came to the conclusion as a Seventh-day Adventist pastor that there's a great controversy between Christ and Satan. It's funny because Adventists actually have a book by that title, right? The Great Controversy Between Christ and Satan. But I had to get it from an evangelical author who wrote a book about the book of Job and was talking about disappointment with God. And in the process of that journey, I felt embarrassed. It's like, I should know this stuff. I should know that the Job story, the big what-if question of the Job story, will somebody love and adore God even if they're not healed?
Even if
they're not restored. Even if they live with chronic pain for the rest of their life. Can they still love God? If my wife lives with chronic pain for the rest of her life, can I still love God? And I walked out of those woods saying, though he slay me, yet will I trust him. I know that my Redeemer liveth. And even if my body is destroyed, yet in my flesh I will see God. The conclusions of Job. The conclusions of Job. We have the need. This great controversy story tells us that human beings have been detached from God. We've become separated from God. Do we have an attachment disorder? Yes. Is it the fault of our parents? Yes, but you've got to go clear back to Adam and Eve to find the parents to really blame for it. Because we've been detached from God. That's why we're broken. That's why we're scarred. And I love it because the story of Daniel, as we have revisited the story of Daniel in this series, the story of Daniel speaks to that issue. Daniel had attachment problems, right?
He'd been separated
from his parents. He'd been separated from his loved ones. He'd been separated from his hopes and his dreams of being a husband and a father, rendered a eunuch by the Babylonian captors.
He lost everything.
He lost everything. He had a very good reason to be disappointed with God. He had a very good reason to be angry. He had a very good reason to be have a scarcity mindset. But what we see in Daniel is we see a man who has abundance. Look at this verse that describes Daniel.
Daniel became distinguished among all the other high officials and satraps because an excellent spirit was in him, and the king planned to set him over the whole kingdom.
Wow.
Well, that sounds like he has something good planned.
You know, does a war ever happen where a prisoner of war ends up possibly being a ruler over the whole kingdom? This is an amazing story. And you read this, the high officials and the satraps, okay? In the Babylonian Empire, there were sorcerers, essentially. There were these people who were kind of the sages, the gurus, the oracles that people went to find out things. And those oracles and those people, some of them had a spirit in them. But what's interesting is they notice a difference between the spirit that is in Daniel and the spirit that is in the satraps and the other leaders in Babylon. And Darius, the Mede, sees in Daniel something that is different than all of those other guys. He has a different spirit in him, an excellent spirit.
And the book of Daniel tells us why.
Yeah, it just continues.
Why he has that.
Continues to
explain. A different attachment.
Yeah. Now notice Daniel's reaction, because the other officials and the satraps become jealous of Daniel. When they see that this Jew, this prisoner of war, this eunuch, might actually be the ruler over the entire kingdom, they say, oh, no, not on our watch. We're the ones that are waiting for this position. And so they begin to conspire against him. And they first of all, they do an evaluation. You know, they send out questionnaires, and they evaluate this guy, and they can't find anything wrong with Daniel. They can't find anything to criticize him for. He is flawless in his work. They can't find anything wrong with him. And so they start to realize the only way we're going to have a problem with Daniel is if it has to do with his faith in God, because there's one place he will not budge. It's actually the source of the excellent spirit that is within him. And that is that he has this very, very close relationship with God. And so the only way that we can deal with Daniel is we've got to make a law.
Having to do with that.
That forces him to choose between his God and this government.
Right.
And so they come up with a law. And the law, of course, is that nobody can pray to any other god except King Darius for, what is it, I think 30 days. Nobody can pray to any other god. And I want you to notice Daniel's response. You think about this. What would your response be if suddenly you couldn't pray to anybody except the President of the United States, or the last President of the United States, if that's more challenging to you, for 30 days, and that's what you had to do. And that was the situation that you were in. What would your response be? I love what Daniel does here.
He says, when Daniel knew that the document had been signed, he went to his house where he had his windows in his upper chamber open toward Jerusalem. So he's not going to hide this. This isn't going to be something he's going to hide. He's going to open up the windows. He's going to let everybody that's walking by see what he's doing.
Seems like this is a great time to claim that Bible verse, right? You know, pray, he who prays in secret will be rewarded publicly. You know, Jesus says, when you pray, go into your closet. I mean, Daniel could have played that card, right? I think it's time for some secret prayer. They're going to kill me if I pray publicly? Oh, I'll just go into my closet. God's cool with that.
He knew, right? This was something that needed to be public.
He had to make a statement. He didn't want to hide it. This mattered so much. And so he goes up to his upper room, where his windows are open toward Jerusalem. This is vital to recognize. He is in exile from Jerusalem. That is where he once had a connection with God through the temple system. And now he's finally opening his windows, and look at what he does.
He gets down on his knees three times a day and prayed and gave thanks before his God as he had done previously. So it was really easy for them to make this rule because they knew what his pattern was.
Daniel had a habit.
He had a habit. Three times a day.
And it's that connection. It's that vital connection that Daniel had with God that is why he has that excellent spirit in him. It's why he has an abundance mindset and not a scarcity mindset. Daniel, the only thing Daniel wants to hoard is prayer. He wants to hoard the presence of God, and he knows that it's so abundant that even if he hoards it all, there will still be enough for everybody else in the world.
Even Nebuchadnezzar.
Of course, they catch Daniel. You see the guys in the picture here. Mm-hmm. They spied him in the window, and they're running off to tell Darius, "Oh, Darius, we've got some really bad news. You know that law you made? What do you know? I mean, how could this have possibly happened? But, you know, turns out Daniel is breaking your rule. And that's a bummer. What are we going to do about that, king? Because this is the laws of the Medes and Persians, and this law can't be changed, so we have to enforce it. And, of course, the punishment is a really nifty punishment.
Mm-hmm.
What do we do with a guy like that? A guy that prays 3 times a day? A guy that needs prayer more than he needs food? Let's throw him in the lion's den. I love this painting. This is by a Spanish artist, a very old painting. I apologize that I don't know the artist's name. But look at I love the look on the face of the lions. Daniel is bound. You see his hands are tied behind his back. He's bound. But look at the lions. The lions don't know what to do with this guy. Anything that falls in their pit, that's just food, you know. Look at, there's still a chunk of meat sitting over there, a bone that's barely got any meat left, a bunch of old bones to the other side. And they're looking at Daniel like, oh man, I don't think we can take this guy. Why? Why can't the lions devour him? Why can't they take him? We're told in the story why. God's angels come in and they shut the lions' mouths. The very presence of God in the life of Daniel gives these lions a bad appetite.
And there's someone else in Scripture that knows this same power. And it's Paul in Philippians. He says, I have learned in whatever situation I am to be content. I know how to be brought low and how to abound.
Paul's speaking of abundance here. And he's saying, I know how to handle scarcity. I know how to handle abundance. And then he says this.
In any and every circumstance, I have learned the secret of facing plenty and hunger, abundance, and need. It takes a different thing with each of those, doesn't it?
So why do you think he says facing plenty? Is it really that hard to face plenty?
Yeah, it's different. It's a different challenge, isn't it?
Why?
Well, you have to decide which kingdom you're going to live in when you're living in plenty or in need.
Plenty has its own challenges.
It has its own challenges.
You know, sometimes, you know, the culture I grew up with in northern Wyoming and Montana, you'd ask somebody, you know, hey, is there anything I can do for you? You know, at a store or something. Hey, can I help you? I heard this just recently on our trip up to Montana. Is there something I can help you with? And I heard the guy reply, yeah, you could give me $1 million. That'd solve all my problems. Would
it? Is it, though?
You know, abundance can create more problems. Read the stories about people who win the lottery. It ruins their lives sometimes. So you have to face plenty.
Yep.
That's a challenge.
You have to face plenty. Hunger, abundance, and need.
Okay.
Both. So in all of those things, Paul knew that he could do all things through Christ who strengthened him. Same thing that Daniel knew. The same source.
So having a scarcity mindset has its own challenges.
Yep.
Having an abundance mindset can also have its own challenges. But you can do all things through Christ who strengthens you. It sounds to me like there's some kind of a source, there's some kind of a connection that fills us to overflowing. Our parents are never enough. Our Adam and Eve parents were never enough.
And the same goes disconnected. The same goes for spouses and friends.
Wait, you're saying I'm not enough?
You're great. But there's still something missing.
Truth.
And that's how it is. Even in the happiest marriages and the happiest friendships, we'd like to be every single thing for each other, but we can't.
I'm sad that I had to discover that in front of all of you today. You're not enough either, mm-hmm. Baby.
I know.
Yeah. Pretty hard to realize, isn't it? Because I think there are certain points in our life where we find the right person and we want to say that line from the movie, "You complete me." Right? And then that person comes into your life and
doesn't work.
They don't quite cut it. Yeah, thanks a lot for sharing that privately like you just did. But it's true. It's true. And we need something else when we're in the lion's den. We need to be filled with something more than whatever anybody else can do for us. And Becky, you faced an experience when you had the accident, when you experienced the paralysis. We had friends sending us collections of tapes. And they were like, listen to these tapes. This guy is a healer.
Right.
One of the verses that they claimed, you know, it's kind of the name it and claim it, faith healing kind of thing. And they said, look at the Lord's Prayer. Your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. So in the Lord's Prayer, we pray that God's will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Is there any cancer in heaven? No. Is there any disease in heaven? Is there any paralysis in heaven? And so the idea was, Becky, there's no paralysis in heaven, so what you need to do is you just need to have a lot of faith and you need to just pray. Your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. There's no paralysis in heaven. There's no burning chronic pain in heaven, so you just need to have enough faith and pray.
Yeah, so I went through that with a lot of my friends and family. Barry told you about his difficult time going through just that dark time of watching me in pain. I remember calling him from the pain clinic, and I think I told you about that several weeks ago, where I discovered that pain is an experience and it's all 100% of the time processed in the brain, and that there's many things I can do about my experience of pain. Originally, I had thought I was going there to have a surgery, and I remember calling home. And because Barry had stayed home, we had an 8-year-old daughter at the time. I guess she was about 10 at that time. And I called home and he said, when is your surgery scheduled? And I said, well, I'm not having surgery. And he said, really? Why? And I said, well, the doctor wants me to go through their program. He wants me to learn some things about managing pain. And he didn't tell me how angry he was. But he was angry. I could tell he was disappointed.
The message I got was, they're just telling me to deal with it.
Yeah, they're telling her to deal with it.
And I was like, I'm going to get on an airplane and I'm going to come help somebody deal with something.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I was...
He wasn't very happy about it. And that's yeah. how the rest of my family felt. Really? There's no cure? This person is going to have to live with burning nerve pain from the neck down, central nerve pain. It's not easy, and she's going to have to live with that for the rest of her life. Maybe there's a cure for it. Maybe there's and I had many people say, you know, God doesn't want to leave you that way. He doesn't want you to be in pain for the rest of your life. And I remember being tempted by that. And then I remembered a scripture that helped me with that. And that was the scripture where Paul says, to keep me from becoming conceited because of my surpassing greatness of the revelations, a thorn was given me in the flesh, a messenger of Satan to harass me, to keep me from becoming conceited.
So this is an interesting picture. The Apostle Paul has had an out of body, he's not sure. He says, whether in the body or out of the body, I don't know. But I was taken to paradise. I was taken to the very presence of God, and I experienced and encountered all the glory of God. And I don't know whether it was in the body or out of the body, but he said, once I got that picture of God, I was given a thorn in the flesh, a messenger of Satan to prevent me from getting conceited.
Yeah, and this is Paul. This isn't little old me.
Yeah.
And how does Paul deal with it? You know, Paul says, 3 times I pleaded with the Lord about this, that it should leave me. But he said to me, my grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. So when a friend comes to me and says, you know, God doesn't want to leave you this way. He doesn't want to see you suffer. Which, by the way, I'm not suffering anymore. I still have the same pain. But as we've talked about, I have lots of different ways of managing it and dealing with it. So I still have the same burning nerve pain from the neck down. I still have the same thorn in the flesh. But one thing that I know, and this is what I tell my friends, I've asked him for healing, and he said no. He said that my grace is sufficient for you. My power is made perfect in your weakness. And that's not an easy answer for me, for family members, for friends.
Tough to accept that one.
It's tough to accept that one. But what happens when acceptance happens is also something that happens in the brain. Therefore, I will boast all the more gladly of my weaknesses so that the power of Christ may rest upon me. I want to just tell you a little bit about the science of pain again. We've been talking about it every week for a few weeks. But there's something magical that happens when we accept something that is. You know, when we're told that something is for the rest of our life, you know, there are some of us that have something like I have. And there's some people that have emotional baggage that they carry from a childhood. There's all kinds of different sorrows and pains that we bear. And there's something that happens when we accept. Before acceptance, for me, it was cure-seeking. I've got to find an answer. I've got to get out of this. There has to be a way out of this. And there's so much anxiety in that. And there's so much relaxation and beauty in that acceptance of God's power in my life as I give myself to Him, like, say, Daniel, three times a day and just give it over to Him. I just give all of this to You because I know that You have an answer to it. You know, I couldn't have imagined in my wildest dreams that God would have the ministry that He's given me with people that have chronic pain. I wouldn't be able to do what I'm doing today in helping people with chronic pain if I didn't have it. It gives me, my neurosurgeon told me one time, he said, "You can say things that I can't say. I know the science, I know how it works, but I can't say it. You can say it." And so God has given me that acceptance. It's in that spending time with Him and letting Him give me the strength in my weakness to do what He's asked me to do. And there's something really beautiful that happens with that.
You know, there's something I want to explain to everybody here, and that is, you may or may not know this, but Becky speaks to thousands of medical doctors and medical providers in conferences all over the place. Medical doctors sit in rooms and listen to Becky speak about chronic pain, and they get continuing education credits doing that. Usually medical doctors get continuing ed credits for listening to another medical doctor or listening to a PhD. What's your level of education?
High school.
She has a high school diploma. Okay. What qualifies her to talk about chronic pain? She has it.
School of hard knocks.
If you didn't have it, nobody'd want to hear what you have to say. And it's a beautiful thing that somehow God can take our worst problem, and He can not only help us to figure out how to have pain but not suffer. That's the beautiful thing that you've discovered, is that you can have pain but not suffer, and that you can have pain, but pain doesn't have to have you.
I do want to say one thing, and that is that I don't think that God caused my accident so He could help people with chronic pain. No. I don't think that He caused the Babylonian exile so that Daniel would be thrown into the lion's den and any of those things. I don't think he caused those things, but I think He uses those thorns in our flesh that we have. Yeah. There are some of us in the congregation that have had different kinds of sorrows and different kind of things in your life, and those are used in other people's lives down the road from that, and I think he uses that.
That's true. I want you to notice Paul's response here. He says, "For the sake of Christ, then, I am content with weaknesses, with insults, with hardships, with persecutions, with calamities, for when I am weak, I am strong." Wow. There's an aha moment that happens.
Yeah, he's getting it.
There's an aha moment that happens.
He asked to get out of it.
Yeah. But he realizes that these things in our lives, scarcity itself, can help us suddenly realize that we are at the end of ourselves, and there's only one thing we need. There's only one thing we need, and that is God. We hoard toilet paper because we want to have independence. That's really it. You know, the whole hoarding mentality when the pandemic happened was a mentality that said, "I want to make sure I have everything so I can be self-sufficient. I can live off the grid. I can bug out, and I can survive." And the reality is, what you're after there is independence, and what you need most in a crisis is dependence on one person, on our Creator God.
Three times a day.
And the reality is, because of our parents, Adam and Eve, We've been separated from God. We've been disconnected with God. And the power of redemption, the work of redemption, is the restoration of us back into relationship with God again. It's why Jesus came. It's why he lived his life of healing. It's why he died on the cross. He died on the cross to reconcile us with the Father. And this Father is a very interesting Father. When we spend our time in prayer, when we spend our time close to God, he takes us through the scariest times, through the lion's den experience. And I want you to notice this experience of Israel in Isaiah. Isaiah is the exile book. This is the book of the prophet speaking to the people of Israel in exile and speaking to them about why they ended up in exile and how they will ever find their way out. And the thing you notice in the book of Isaiah, tons of messianic prophecies, tons of prophecies announcing that the Messiah is coming. And notice this prophecy here.
Rejoice with Jerusalem. Oh, thus saith the Lord, heaven is my throne and the earth is my footstool. This is the one to whom I will look, he who is humble and contrite in spirit and who trembles at my word.
God's saying to these people, what I need from you most is a humble spirit. I don't want the offering of oxes and of lambs. He says that offering a sacrifice is like offering pig's blood on my altar. I don't want that. I want a humble and contrite spirit. I want somebody who trembles at my word.
Rejoice with Jerusalem and be glad for her, all you who love her. Rejoice with her in joy, all you who mourn over her, that you may nurse and be satisfied from her consoling breast, that you may drink deeply with delight from her glorious abundance.
Here, the city of Jerusalem is being used as a metaphor for union with God. For people in exile, to be back in Jerusalem is to be reconnected with God again. If I have an attachment issue that I'm detached from God and I have this scarcity mindset and I feel like I need to hoard things to try to fill that empty place, there's only one place that I can find that. And for the Jews in that day, it was to be in Jerusalem, to be in the temple, to be reunited with God through this system. And so Jerusalem is described as a nursing mother who feeds and fills her child to abundance. And psychologists actually say that the nursing process is part of how a child gets a sense of abundance and not have a sense of scarcity.
For thus saith the Lord, behold, I will extend peace to her like a river, and the glory of the nations like an overflowing stream. And you shall nurse, you shall be carried upon her hip and balanced upon her knees.
Now, Becky and I made a discovery on our vacation, and that was that on our vacation, we discovered the cutest baby in the world. And we'd like to show you the cutest baby in the world now, because I think it's important to bring some of those discoveries back home and to share it with all of our congregation. I shouldn't say this. We saw some really cute babies in the lobby this morning. So
yeah,
this is one of the cutest babies in the world, okay? And here he is. And I want you to notice not only what he's doing, but notice how he's looking, the expressions on his face, and notice the sounds that you hear in the background. Here we go.
Careful. Whoa.
He actually said a word there. He said, stop, because the music stopped, and he was really bummed about the music stopping, and then game's over when the music stops. I mean, right, the party's over. But I want you to notice what's going on there, right? What do you see there? You see a child. First of all, he has to be on a platform, right? He's on a stage. Why is he on a stage? Because he wants to be seen. And then he does his little dance. He does his little thing. And he's talking and he's looking at his who. Who's he looking at? Who's in the background? Who do you think that is?
Mom.
That's mom. That's his mother. And she's looking at him. He's being seen. He's being beheld. He's being adored. He's being loved. And in the process, he knows who he is. When he's seen by his mother, when he's nurtured by his mother, when he's fed by his mother, he knows who he is. It's a beautiful thing. Maybe we'll tell you who that kid is later. But I love this last verse in the book of Isaiah.
As one whom his mother comforts, so will I comfort you. You shall be comforted in Jerusalem. You shall see, and your heart shall rejoice. Even in the hard times, even when you have a thorn in the flesh, he's there. He's comforting us.
Can you imagine God, not just as your Father in heaven, but as this nurturer, as one who whom his mother comforts, I will comfort you. You shall be comforted in Jerusalem. You shall see, and your heart shall be rejoiced. Handel in the Messiah writes a song, "Comfort ye, my people. Your warfare has ended. Your suffering is over." Why is it over in that context? In the Isaiah context, it's over because Messiah Jesus has come.
Jesus, yeah.
And he's reunited us with the Father who is this source of nurturing comfort, the source of abundance, the only place we can be filled. It's our prayer that you too will encounter and know the scarcity of abundance.